This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast. Hello, welcome to Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. I'm your host, Claire, and we've got an important mission this month. It is Brain Tumor Awareness Month, and we're shedding light on a crucial issue. Brain tumors claim more lives among children and adults under 40 than any other cancer. Shockingly, only 1% of the national spend on cancer research is allocated to this silent threat. Because today, right here on Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show, we're taking a stand. We're not just talking statistics. We're sharing stories, real heartfelt stories from people all around the globe who have been touched by a brain tumor. It's time to raise our voices and spread the word. By listening in, you're joining a movement to make a difference. Welcome, Rudy.
Thank you for having me.
We've spoken many times through the years. Things have changed in your journey because I think tell our listeners about it.
Yeah, I was officially diagnosed in 2018. I had probably about 4 or 5 years of just weird, odd symptoms. I had like bouts of vertigo and just felt off. I was getting really tired and just had trouble concentrating on certain things. And so over the period of about 4 or 5 years, I was visiting various doctors. I was diagnosed with allergies, a pinched nerve in my neck, even exhaustion. I was never at any point ever given the option of even paying for the MRI out of pocket, which I probably would have done, but no, that never happened. I had to travel to another state. I happened to be going there just for business stuff and set up an MRI while I was there because the various laws allowed me to get an MRI and have insurance pay for at least some of it.
Why do you think the doctors didn't pick up on this?
I think this is actually a big problem for many people who are trying to get diagnosed with all sorts of ailments. It's just, I think they, I don't want to say that they are discounting what patients are saying, but I do think that there is a tendency to not necessarily explore all options. They're looking for the most likely, and I understand why that is. In my particular case, just living in the state where I do in Tennessee, the laws are such that really the insurance companies actually dictate a lot of the care, a lot more than people actually think. They will second guess and not approve certain treatments just because, in my case, because of my age, I was in my mid-40s and I was doing triathlons and things like that. And so I was in pretty good shape. It was just viewed as not likely by the insurance companies that this was a possibility. So they would never approve MRI orders.
When you got the diagnosis, and that was after having a biopsy, somebody pretty much ran after you to say, hold on, we want to talk to you.
Yeah, this was my preliminary MRI that kind of started it all. Like, I never really expected it to be anything serious. I just figured, oh, we're just checking this off the list of possibilities of what's going on with me. I remember July 9th, 2018, and I parked in space 187. And those familiar with the American crime codes will appreciate that number. It's the number in most areas for homicide. I parked there just as a joke to myself and then walked in to get the MRI and then got the MRI and then just waiting afterwards. They wanted me to wait 15 minutes or so before I left. And I was just sitting on my laptop doing some work related to business. And
what do you think they were going to say to you?
I thought that they would just be like, we don't see anything abnormal, go on your way. So I was getting ready to leave, just assuming that nothing was going on. They actually asked for my car key. And said that they couldn't allow me to drive because there was a mysterious mass in my brain, particularly in my brainstem and cerebellum, and that a good chunk of my fourth ventricle, for those where the controls like your lungs and your heart and things like that, was nearly closed. So they're like, you should not be driving because you could
have a nuts.
You could have at any moment.
Yeah.
So they took my car keys. I was then got a taxi to the nearest hospital where I checked in. Unfortunately, it was a pretty good hospital in terms of brain tumor stuff is concerned. And I was rushed into emergency surgery. So the rest has been a very interesting journey, to say the least.
Yeah. So you had to have two craniotomies.
Yeah. The first one, I developed some weird infections. They went back in just to make sure everything needed. So the second one was much shorter. I think part of the problem again with the private insurance system in the United States. There was some bickering going on, and basically my head was left open for way longer than it should have, about 12 hours, where I think most people are aware of craniotomies, even a long one might last like 6 hours. So being open that long is just, obviously there's more risk for complications, I'll say that.
Once you've had that surgery, and were you sent away to be told now you've got to have rehabilitation, and they were confident that they'd got rid of the tumor, or did they say you may need to have more tests?
They did send the tissue off for analysis and all that, but they told me they only were able to get some of it just because of the location. The cerebellum and the brainstem are very fragile areas. So they only even bothered to go after probably maybe a third of it. And there's some that told me that this is going to be an ongoing thing. I'm going to need regular MRIs, and I'll probably need some sort of physical therapy and ongoing treatment. They decided that I was going to go through chemo and radiation just because I was young and so healthy. They were just going to go ahead and be aggressive. So they didn't want to watch and wait with me. And honestly, I don't know if I had been more educated at that time, if I would have chosen anything different, it may have been exactly the same. Okay. I just went along with whatever they were recommending. So
that's something we're going to talk about, treatment options.
Absolutely. I think for me and a lot of other people, you just accept whatever a doctor is saying at face value. And I think there's a lot of value and importance of that. But I think it's also important for patients to understand that they do have a voice. It's a medical team, and the patient is very much a part of that. Mm. I view the patient as the team captain, and then like the doctors may be like the conciliary. It's like a bad analogy because it's not sports related, but it's a coach of some sort that is very educated and whose opinion should be taken maybe more serious than a lot of other people. But ultimately, it's the patient who needs to be making the decisions.
When I had mine, it happened all so fast. So I wish I'd had a few options as to where I had it, because of the surgeons do it slightly differently, don't they? It's how they go in, and some will have different technology that's a lot more safer, whereas others, they just go straight in and hit whatever they hit, and then you lose whatever you lose.
Yeah, and some hospitals along those lines, some hospitals are just, and it's more routine for them. So in retrospect, I probably could have waited a day or two before I was rushed into surgery. Yeah. But again, I don't know, that would have changed my decision, but I know definitely I didn't even realize I had a choice.
Yeah, so. You were told it had gone into a grade 3, then told you it had gone into a grade 4. That's a massive change from a grade 2 to a 4.
Basically, like many patients, I was given radiation and standard of care chemotherapy, which is temozolomide or TMZ or Temodar, whatever you want to call it. I was on that for a while, and on my first major MRI, which was, I guess, was 3 months after I finished radiation, there was growth. And there's always the question of, is this like necrosis from cells dying off, whatever? But they were pretty sure this was actual growth and not just some sort of like phantom tissue thing. Mm-hmm. But mine was definitely, everybody felt it was actual progression. And as it turned out, I was later genomically tested, had some genomes tested. And it turns out that for whatever reason, that the markers in my brain were shown to react adversely to what's considered standard of care. Again, that Temodar or the TMZ or the temozolomide. So it actually had triggered my tumor to grow some more. Oh. So I was then moved up to grade 4. They said GVM at that point. They didn't have an Astro grade 4 because those changes happened in 2021, I believe. But yeah, so that was an interesting day.
Yes.
In my life, being told that your grade 2 is not great, but it's generally least associated with longer survival time. Being told that maybe there's a good chance that you'd make it 8 or 9 years, perhaps longer, and then being told that you had, my oncologist at the time told me that I had probably, based on what she was seeing, probably a year.
That must have been such a shock. It must have been horrendous for your family to come to terms with that. Does it play on your mind?
Fortunately, she was wrong.
Yes.
Honestly, for me, I was, and I think many patients go through this, I think some get very emotional and drastic. For me, I don't think I really fully processed it until months later. I definitely was starting to get scared and concerned and all of that, but I don't think it hit me quite as heavy as it probably should have. Fortunately, I was able to go to a more, because the original oncologist I was seeing was at a general hospital. It wasn't a brain tumor specific one. I would definitely do whatever you can to go. That was a huge difference because I know my wife and I, we got the will ready. We got all the medical sort of things, everything in order very quickly, just in case everybody was right and just hope that they weren't right. But when I went to a brain tumor specific, like an actual neuro-oncologist, it was a very different sort of conversation. So I had been upgraded to GBM at that point. Oh. And then my new oncologist, the neuro-oncologist, you know, at the brain tumor specific said, based on what she was seeing and other factors, she was like seeing it more as potentially a 3. And so that's, she ordered genomic testing, which kind of backed that up. They retested my original tissue sample from my biopsy. And they were like, this is like somewhere between a 2 and 3. I was put on a Avastin and I did very well. I've done very well on it. I was told I'd be on it for the rest of my life. I was on it for about 3 years and I was taken off about 2 years ago and I've been stable ever since. So
that's brilliant. That's
who knows?
Yeah.
It could be the Avastin. It could just be that I'm just have dumb luck on my side.
Also, I don't know about right now, but you were very active, very fit. Do you think that made any difference? You've got a lot to live for. Your family are the biggest. Do you think that makes a difference?
I think it definitely plays a factor. I was actually looking back at like when we originally spoke, and I remember talking about how one of my goals before I was diagnosed was to do an Ironman triathlon before I was 50.
Did you do it?
I still want to do an Ironman. I just am not putting a time limit on it.
Yeah.
I think that I was a bit naive at the time. I've continued to be very as physically fit as I can with my balance and coordination issues just because I do have some left side weakness. But I don't think of them as, I try as much as I can not to think of them as limitations as much as I think of them as challenges.
Yeah.
I think that in most cases, I don't want to say that I can't do something. I just say that I have to figure out a way to adapt and get around it, to figure out how to do something, do whatever it is that I want to do. It may not be done in the traditional way, but I'll still figure out a way to meet the same end result. I think that has, that sort of mindset has been very important for me and helped me to not beat myself up, because I think a lot of people do that. They get very frustrated. They're not walking the way they used to walk, or they not seeing the way they used to see, or they're not remembering the things they used to remember, or a combination of all three, or other things, having seizures every other day. You know, it's very easy to beat yourself up and think that you can't do things. And there might be some things that maybe aren't the wisest to go after, realistic expectations. Yeah. I think there's ways of doing it. Like, for instance, with the triathlon thing, like it's actually difficult for me to ride a bike just because of my balance issues, but they do allow for modified, call them recumbent bikes. So I ride that. I've adapted. I don't swim as fast as I used to. I don't run as fast as I used to, but I still can do those. Maybe not as quickly as I would like, but I'm still moving faster than a walk. So one of the things my neuro-oncologist, when I did start seeing her, she said that there are loads of ways that somebody can address all the things that come with a brain tumor, whether it's alternative therapies or traditional medicine or whatever. But she said two of the things that are extremely clinically, have a lot of clinical evidence and very easy for anybody to do is daily physical activity. Again, it doesn't need to be grueling or whatever. You just need to move and you need to use your brain. I took both of those items very much to heart. I think that sort of daily activity really has helped me quite a bit just to feel better about myself. Also, I work into that. You had mentioned my kids earlier. Mm. I think my kids are a huge motivator just because I want to do stuff with them. I want to go on walks with them. I want to play with them. And maybe I'm not resting around with them on the ground, but there are things I can do, whether it's just kicking a ball around or it's doing an art project with them, it's just spending time with them. It gets me out of bed for sure, just because I want to be as active and hands-on as I can be.
That's the physical side. Something people may not know, you do videos on YouTube and Substack.
I do think of being creative as being a form of cognitive therapy and just using my brain. I spent a little over 20 years doing all sorts of what they call it. Infotainment was originally what it was called. It's basically like pseudo documentary stuff that you see on television. Back in the day, it used to be just be like animal videos, and then it's evolved into different sort of science and history. So I was very heavily involved with that for a number of years, and gradually drifted into true crime just because that's where the work was.
I love true crime. I sit there and I'm convinced I know what's going on. My husband is always, oh my gosh, why did you know that? I'm like, because I just know.
I've heard that a lot. I've interviewed probably well over 1,000 people.
Wow.
For all these different sorts of programs that I've done. So it's given me a little bit of it. I'd like to think a little bit of insight.
Yeah.
She's human nature.
Did you feel that you used some of those techniques for your YouTube channel, which is the Brain Cancer Diaries? Because it's not just a...
Yeah.
You've done a production.
Honestly, I think it's like many people, they when they go through the brain tumor experience and they're recovering, they just long for their prior selves in some ways. And for me, it was a little bit of that, just because I wasn't able to go back to work. I wanted to do something. And while it took me a lot longer to do videos that were much simpler than what I had done previously, I was still doing them. Mm-hmm. So I felt like a little bit like my old something, but it was just a different topic.
Yeah.
In terms of talking to people and what we were talking about. And I think over time, my approach to it has shifted greatly. There's actually another person from the UK. She's named Sarah Cross. I want to say Crossfield.
Crossland. I know who
Cross.
Yes.
Yeah. She had a profound impact on me when I talked to her, and she was like, I don't want a new normal. I want to be better than I was before. And that really resonated with me. And so I've really taken that to heart. And so in terms of how it shaped the various videos and say a podcast or podcast appearances that I've done, it's really made me think about them a little bit differently in terms of what my motivation for doing them. I want to be the person I always told myself that I would be when I had more time later down the road before my diagnosis. And now that I actually found myself, while I'm not necessarily doing the exact same thing professionally that I was before, I am doing a lot more of sort of the stuff I told myself that I would do someday, whether it's spending more time trying to make a difference in some way, making the world a little bit better for others, or just doing something I've always wanted to do creatively.
So you're still on YouTube, but you've joined Substack.
Yeah, Substack is more like a blog / newsletter site. So it's more text-based, although there is a video element to it. Like I will post like some of the YouTube videos I do on there.
Oh, so it's called thatcancerlife.substack.
Yeah, That Cancer Life is the name of the Substack, but also if you just go to thatcancerlife.com, it has a link to like all the various things that I've done on there. Including one of the links is because the other side of my life is doing patient advocacy work on a clinical basis. There's a thing called the low-grade glioma registry, which is an international thing where they're just collecting like patient information to help with various studies related to brain tumors and things like that.
How did you find out about that?
I just kept raising my hand in various ways, whether making a video or a blog post or something like that, or just literally just sending an email to an organization and just saying, hey, this is my situation. Is there any way I can help out? There's that. Plus, I think people just know look for listening. So I actually, the big one that I'm involved in right now is that low-grade glioma registry. They actually contacted me, but it was somebody else with a brain tumor in the United States had recommended me, who was one of the investigators on it. And so they reached out to me, but it was largely just because I just make myself a nuisance and keep raising
available.
My hand and putting annoying content.
No, you make
keep
yourself
putting
available.
My content out.
Yeah.
You know how it goes when you're promoting anything. It's just about, you got to keep letting people know that you're there. Mm. And it took two to three years before anybody reached out to me, but it happened eventually. So if there's something that anybody listening to this wants to do, it's be a little proactive and put yourself out there, which is hard for some people.
Mm.
I think that there is power in talking to other patients specifically about cancer stuff, but there's also power in not talking about cancer stuff. I think it's real easy for people to get lost in sort of the identity of having a brain tumor. I think it's important that it's always there in the background, but it may define certain areas of your life, but it doesn't necessarily define who you are as a human.
It's hard.
Yeah, it is very hard because,
yeah.
I mean, it's like, I was trying to think about how much I think about cancer on some level or having a brain tumor on some level throughout the day. And it's pretty frequent, like just getting up to walk to the kitchen in my house, it's a little wobbly. I mean, not say the word, oh, that's the cancer, but I know that's the cause of why I have to grab onto a wall or a railing here that are there so I can rebalance myself. So that's pretty, even people with the sort of best circumstances where like they're doing pretty well, there's still always that sort of fear of recurrence in the back of your mind.
Yeah, it's also things that have happened to you. I am partially blind, so it's impossible not to remind me of what I've gone through because
yes.
I walk into things and I know I'm like, oh, great, thanks very much. But you're just living it. There's nothing. I have to take medication every day. It's just a constant reminder.
Absolutely. It's just omnipresent. Even if you have the best of attitude, it's hard not to be reminded of it. And I think what's important is just to remind yourself of the things, like I said earlier, how can I adapt around this situation to still go after things? I think that can't let the issues, the physical issues, and the mental issues just control all areas of your life. I think it's important to face those to a certain extent, but I think there's also a time and place. And it's also important to remind yourself of the good things in your life. It's very easy to forget about that. It's a very all-consuming thing. You'd mentioned trauma earlier. I was speaking to a former Marine veteran in the United States here who was a combat soldier. And he was a caretaker to his wife, who has since passed. But he said that going through his wife having a brain tumor was more terrifying to him than removing landmines in the Middle East.
Wow.
It's just that they have, his reasoning was that they have the equipment that helps them have a pretty good idea of what's going on. But with a brain tumor, you never know what's going to happen. And he's seen fellow soldiers get killed by landmines, but it's still just different. There's an expectation of what might happen. And it's just, for him, he said it was more terrifying and more traumatizing in many ways to deal with seeing his wife go through a brain tumor.
Well, I suppose experience. You're trained.
So,
You're trained for the army or for whatever if you're doing Navy or anything, but you're not trained for a brain tumor. Like there's no training. I find it bizarre how they'll say to you, brain tumors stay fairly rare. Whatever someone says about a brain tumor in terms of treatment, they're like, oh, there's still not so many treatments as there is in other cancers. I'm like, why?
Oh.
I see so many people get them. I meet so many people outside of RTM brain tumors that have been affected in some way by a brain tumor. I find it strange how like funding and stuff is so low here.
Yeah, it's low here too.
Really?
It's part of it is just, I think I'd mentioned earlier about the WHO grading changing, classifications changing in 2021. And as it is right now, there's over 120 types of brain tumors that are recognized.
It's crazy.
And that's a lot to think about tackling. And sure, some of those are more common than others, but the funding is not quite the same as it is for other cancers. I think it's far more complicated.
Yeah.
And there's just not the public or the, in terms of the funding, is just, I don't think it's quite understood by a lot of people. And so that's part of the holdup.
I had someone that was a doctor and he said the reason it's not so funded and stuff, it's actually because there's not enough people who turn to be a brain tumor doctor that don't want that as being the part they go and work under. Like they'll go and work for breast cancer, but no one seems to want to take on brain cancer because it's so complicated.
Do you want to hear a crazy statistic?
Yeah.
I actually had a very interesting conversation with a neuro-oncologist from the National Cancer Institute here in the United States about this. My own neuro-oncologist, who was part of the original study that approved, got approval for Temodar or Temozide approved in the United States for standard of care use, coincidentally. But it's actually two statistics. One is the type of cancer doctor with the highest rate of job satisfaction are neuro-oncologists, but also the highest rate of death by suicide are neuro-oncologists.
Wow.
So I can see why doctors shy away from it. It's an emotionally heavy, heavier sort of field to go into. So I'm not sure I'd want to be a neuro-oncologist.
No,
There's a choice.
Thank God for the ones that have taken on that challenge. So I want to look at the cancer rock opera that you've been doing it for a while, and you're doing it for a fundraising for Teen Cancer America. And also I saw the Teenage Cancer Trust. So this has been
those two charities are very closely aligned. Essentially, Teen Cancer America grew out of the Teen Cancer Trust in the UK, because the main issue is The Who, the rock band. The Who has just always been a favorite group of mine. They're associated as an early influence along with the Kinks on punk movement. Just a lot in the song structures and the approach and the attitude. Lyrically, a lot of the songs are not necessarily like straightforward love songs. They're about issues. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do a rock opera.
Yeah.
And since The Who is so closely associated with rock, the idea of rock operas, having done two major ones and inspiring loads of other bands to do the same thing, figured that would be a sort of clever way of doing it. And since The Who, particularly Roger Daltrey, had been a sort of ambassador for the Teen Cancer Trust in the UK for decades, really. And then he was very active in starting Teen Cancer America, which has a very sort of similar function and goals in the United States. And they've been in the US probably about 6 or 7 years now, and they've built a number of wards for hospitals, their teen cancer wards. So, because a lot of times teens, say people in their early 20s, they don't fit in a pediatric ward, and they don't fit in with the old people who have, they're a little bit cooler in the way they look. There are various musical artists who will come by, and they also too, for the patients who are musically inclined, they do record, they have these programs where they take them into recording studios to record songs with studio musicians and things like that. So it's a pretty cool charity.
Yeah.
But anyway, the rock opera itself, it's cancer oriented. It's a cancer themed rock out. Every song, there's well over 30 songs in it at this point, because I've been working on it for 3+ years.
Yeah.
It's almost done. But yeah, every single song relates to cancer. It follows the journey of a teen cancer brain tumor patient who is also a pop star and is diagnosed, and the changes he goes through over various years. And the one song that you sang on, it deals with the issue of memories. I think anybody who's gone through a brain tumor they long for a version of their previous self, which can be motivating, but it can also be very hindering, because you get lost and depressed over who I was. Yeah. I'm not that person anymore, and life is terrible. But yeah, so that song that you think, Memories Are a Dangerous Game, because sure, it's nice to reminisce about pleasant things, but it can also trigger a lot of negative emotions. But yeah, so all the songs are like that. Say, for instance, there's a song about media betrayal, a portrayal of cancer. There's things about facing sort of mortality, things about relationships. The idea of cancer ghosting, how a lot of friends will disappear from your life when you're diagnosed. The idea of a lot of songs are geared towards identities. I think that's a huge issue, part of the brain tumor experience and cancer in general.
Is there a way that people can get involved to help a bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking for help, actually. Where I'm at right now, songs are almost written, but I want to go back and re-record a few parts and redo a few things. And also, too, I'm looking for people to play various roles, and not all of them are necessarily singing. Right now, I have probably about 30 folks who are doing things such as just speaking, just because the way the rock opera is told, it's told in the format of a TV documentary about a musical artist. So it just follows a path. There's a format. So there's like pseudo like sound bites from interviews and things like that of people. And there's so many people say those. There's probably about 7 or 8 people who are like singing or playing an instrument on a song. And I certainly need more of that. So anybody who's interested in doing that, I would say go to thatcancerlife.com and you'll see all my links to various social media. I think that even one of the links in there is just to send me an email directly. But you can certainly contact me by leaving a comment on a video or a Substack, or reach out to me through private message or anything on any social media things that I'm involved with.
Yeah, hopefully.
I'm very open to people reaching out.
Okay. I'm excited. I'm really looking forward to it.
Right now I'm aiming. It's certainly taken a lot longer than I thought it would. I thought it would be like a year thing. And now we'll be at 4 years next spring. And that's what I'm hoping to have it done.
You've had quite a lot going on in between those. You've had a lot going on.
Yeah, I get distracted a lot. I get distracted by everything. I'm almost there.
Thank you very much for sharing your story. And thank you for also taking the time to want to help other people that have been affected by a brain tumor. It's not an easy thing to do. Sometimes it can be a trigger. And so thank you for just still doing that. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for doing all the things that you've done over the years as well. I find you just as fascinating as myself. But anyway, thank you for having me.
That's
exactly what you said. I think it's just really important to do what you can while you can and whatever it is. Even if it's very small, it may actually be a bigger thing than you think it is.
Yeah.
And if you're fortunate enough and live a long time, all those small things can add up to something big, like a rock opera.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we hope someone out there is going to come and reach out to Rudy.
I'm certainly open to collaborating on any and all of this.
Thank you very much for sharing your story and for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast.